Then let me welcome you once again to the panel discussion on decoding the human genome and patenting human bio genes. I'd like to welcome our three panelists. We have three people participating. Uta Wagenmann, who's been working in Berlin in this field for a number of years. Then we have sociologist Dr. Andreas Lösch from the University of Freiburg, and on your left, Sylvia Mattis, a TV journalist. And quite possibly some of you has already seen the odd documentary which she's made. We thought that all three panelists should offer you a brief statement stating their position, just to get the ball rolling, and that we would then discuss these positions, and if you have questions or wish to participate quickly in the debate, then you should do so. We would like to cordially invite you to ask your questions or to tell us what you think. Could I just ask you please to use a microphone for a very simple reason, that only voices that are input into a microphone end up in the interpreter's ears and can be interpreted. So Uta Wagenmann will begin. Yes, I'm going to begin in a rather general sense by talking about the... Let's hope this mic behaves itself till I've finished. About the genesis and the framework, political and economic framework in which the genesis of this human genome project has taken place. I'd like to raise a few questions and mention a few facts. Genome research has always been accompanied by many promises of curing, healing. That began in the 80s when the research hadn't really got underway properly, that they promised that for preventing disease and healing disease, these methods would be useful. And that was always the underlying tenor of the discourse. Today, in very different forms, we're seeing discussion of embryonic stem cells as the core of these new opportunities for fighting disease. Sorry, we have to interrupt the interpreting. There's a discussion going on in the background up here.
Die Forschungspolitik in den Industriestaaten schon seit längerem ist. Also dieser Diskurs über die Abwanderung von Firmen in die in andere Länder, wenn man hier nicht Gesetze liberalisiert, dem begegnen wir ja auch immer noch. Der ist ja noch nicht wertlos geworden für die
Liberalisierung. The conversation up here seems to be over. Right. There have always been economic interests in this research. It was part of the deregulation debate. There have been strong lobbies, interests on the part of big companies and other economic lobbies to have access to the research, to disclose their research. I'm talking about the German situation now and our constitutional framework, but I'm sure a lot of this is relevant to other countries. This discourse about Germany and how important it is for Germany as a location for industry to offer access to this research, I've been following since the 80s when they started talking about marketing genetically modified crops. At the time, they were talking about, it was very powerful companies who were going abroad, and there was a threat, if you like, to the economic cycle back home as a result of that flight, that migration. And then when the discourse began to concentrate on the red genetic technology, that is medical research, the discussion got going again. So at the latest in the early 90s, and primarily in 1995, when the German government decided that we should join the Human Genome Project, the debate picked up again. The state research program, which includes competitions, money for startups and so forth, you can follow all this in the last few years. From year to year, this has been growing in magnitude, this kind of support. There are also tax breaks for startups in these new genetic technologies, above all the medical technologies. And if we look at legislation, above all patents, which tends to be dealt with at European level, this patent directive was adopted and is now being transposed. It has been transposed into German legislation about 10 days ago when it was debated, at least in the Bundestag. And as part of that research policy, which is regarded as part of Germany's policy for attracting industry, we've seen a lot about these kind of arguments and interests. The other side to this is the structure of research. How is it organized? In the 90s, we saw an economic shift here. More and more startups committed to this kind of research, which means that capital equity has to be derived from the share markets, the capital markets, and that is obviously related to the kind of output of this research. It's very important for a lot of companies at least to come up with a number of prospects, to publicize a number of future options and potential which they feel that their research is likely to lead to in terms of applications. In order to generate a climate in which these small companies will benefit from investment, above all if they are companies listed on the stock exchange. So to sum that up, genes, genetics, the genes as the smallest unit in that scientific complex, are ultimately just a virtual configuration. There's certainly an artificial configuration which offers a great deal of potential. And this works according to similar principles as we normally see on stock markets. In the 90s, as before, of course, there were the big pharmaceuticals companies who were engaged in their own research and spending considerable budget resources on that. Not a lot has changed there. They are a lot more static in that respect. But in addition to them, now we have all these myriad small companies who have incorporated the shareholding logic into their business plans. And that's why we're hearing more and more promises of rapid outcomes. And that has affected the way we perceive this business of curing diseases. This is the way that the public is encouraged to perceive genetic research, that it is related to promises of medical results. A week ago, for example, I was on a playground with my child and the parents were sitting on the bench next to me. I was reading the newspaper, and of course every now and then you can't help hearing what other people are saying. I think they were left-wing intellectuals, teachers or something like that, who were talking about the rather difficult social composition of our district and the problem children. And I heard things like one of them saying very thoughtfully, "Well, I have to say, to be plain, I'm beginning to think it has something to do with their genetic equipment." It sounded pretty harmless, but of course that relates to, it's a way of dealing with, or a way of responding to social problems that people have. But I think we're hearing this more frequently, and also people with various disabilities are increasingly hearing, "Oh, that kind of thing wouldn't be necessary these days. What a shame they were born that way. We could avoid all that." This biologization, which is associated with our genetic knowledge increasingly, is based, I think, around three components. And I'd like to mention those. First of all, there's the discourse around the genetic fingerprint. This began very early. the discussion about the tremendous opportunities that this new technology offered for fighting crime and identifying criminals. So that suggested that we are our DNA, our identity is our DNA. We have it there, black on white. It is our fingerprint, our identity. And at the same time, we hear again and again about particular genes which have been identified as generating certain forms of behavior or diseases or character traits. And so we're hearing more and more how genes are making an incursion into the area of social behavior. And that is making that a constant component in the debate, and then that's the ideology underlying it. And the third component is the biologization which is taking place at personal, individual level with regard to medicine. That is the application of this genetic knowledge would make it possible to take tests. There are more than 300 on offer now, and each year we get another 40 or 50 more. So the number of these tests that are available are increasing because companies are trying to come up with marketable applications, and what you can market above all is tests. Therapeutic applications are pretty negligible. There are hardly any in that field. So that is how we get a kind of biologization at the individual level. These tests, I think, mean let's take very harmless gene tests, which relate to certain external appearance, factors of appearance, which are reduced to genetic influences. That is, we are not thinking of these external signs any longer as being external. We're beginning to believe increasingly that we can trace their roots back to somewhere inside the human being. So if we think about the effect all of this can have not only on pathologies and treating disease, but also on human development, there's an idea that we are equipped with certain things when we come into the world, therefore we are prescribed and we can't change it anymore. And all that's going to happen then is just a kind of film running. It's already been designed and determined. So I think this kind of biologization is reflected in all those tests and tools of diagnosis which we're seeing arising from the application of genetic research. And anything that relates to environmental influence or social influence and structure is taking a passenger seat in the discussion. I'll pass on to Andreas now to continue with the discussion. Okay. Then I'd like to pick up a little where Uta Wagenmann left off and pick up on some of those arguments, but I'd also like to venture an additional perspective. I wanted to talk about a certain form of discourse about the legitimacy or not of gene patents and about how the way we talk about patenting genes relates to particular forms of self-perception, above all in the context of genetic consultancy which is being created in the clients for genetic consultancy. So we're talking about people being persuaded to voluntarily participate in tests. It's a kind of self-eugenization of these clients, and how in turn this participation in genetic consultancy is a point of departure, a launch pad for the development of a genetic economy. It's a kind of vicious circle, and I'm kind of going to try and sum it up in 8 hypotheses. So the point of departure is the current debate about whether human genome sequences can be patented. We have this in the directive of the European Union of 1998, which says that human genetic sequences can be patented if they can be isolated from their natural environment. which is a pretty trivial thing to say, because in any laboratory experiment, they have been isolated from their natural environment, which is the human being. But there's an argument about whether these genome sequences can be patented, because really they are natural. Or are they a technical invention? And one important criterion for patenting is being a technical invention. Another thing is the general use that is made of this invention for society. The argument is above all about whether these DNA sequences are an invention or not. If they're not an invention, then perhaps they can't be patented, because they are simply a discovery of something that exists in the natural state. And it's this assumption, it sounds a little alienating perhaps, but this assumption that the genome is natural, or that at least the genome that is being patented can be challenged on that basis. The first hypothesis is that this genome, which decodes the genome, which the Genome Project attempts to decode, is not natural. The idea that the genome is the natural origin of human beings is demonstrated in terms of metaphors, such as we hear about the Book of Life, or decoding the genome, or reading the genetic code. And this implies that by means of molecular biology taking place in the laboratory, some kind of genetic standards for human beings can be consigned to paper. It's a metaphysical discourse which does not do justice to the production of knowledge in modern science. It's quite clear in experimental laboratory conditions today, the thing that is identified is produced in the laboratory, and that is the object of our perceptions. The second thing is, do I want to decode the genome? If I do, then I have to recombine the DNA. I have to combine it, I have to multiply it in order to generate a physical map. And it's only when I do that that I have an object for my scientific activity, but it's completely transformed, the original product. So what is being transformed here is basically a text. The genetic code is understood as a text consisting of A, G, C, and T, the four base substances. In June 2000, a German daily newspaper printed the sequence, it took pages and pages of the newspaper. And this brings me on to my second hypothesis. This question, what are all these ACs, Gs, and Ts for? One might have wondered at the time why the newspaper devoted so many pages to printing this row of letters. But the question how this text is generated is interesting. It's a completely meaningless text. It just consists of four letters with which the names of these substances begin. And of course, that text is a technological inventment. And that text, if we just consider it in isolation, doesn't indicate anything. It doesn't tell us anything about natural processes. It's an artifact. And this artifact could basically be regarded as an invention. So, according to patent law, not every invention is actually patentable. It has to promise some kind of usefulness, and it has to be marketable in some way. And at least in the EU directive, it says that the genes which are to be patented, or the text which is to be patented, or the segments of text to be patented, have to be described in their functional purpose. And that brings me on to the next hypothesis. People say it cannot be that these meaningless DNA texts, these genes, should be patented if nobody knows what they actually mean. And I would say, okay, well, that's really not the point, because for the biotechnological industry, ultimately, it is actually quite important that we are not just talking about the text. Because what is economically valuable for this industry is genetic information about predispositions to certain diseases, the odds that those diseases will develop, and that is very important in terms of the demand for DNA tests on decoding. And that assumes that the DNA sequences contain multi-layered information about diseases, but that they can be combined with other data about our habits, our lives. These would be used, this linked data would be used to set up risk profiles. And a molecular test of this kind would establish a certain DNA sequence, and only in combination with the other data would a diagnosis or a probability ratio be possible. That relates to the risk of disease and makes decisions possible about these diseases. It's quite possible that genetic, it's quite clear that genetic research wishes to go further down that road. But I would say that this linked data isn't something that the laboratories have invented with their molecular biology. That's, after all, what they want to patent. But in the directive, they are implicitly treated as if they were an invention of the laboratories, because it says we can only patent these things if we can describe their functions. This economically valuable information is essentially being invented by the clients of genetic consultancy, people who want PGD. These linked data are put together as a result of interviews with the consultant in a genetic practice, for example, or in human genetics. And generating a diagnosis through the consultancy assumes that the patients are going to tell the consultant a lot of information about diseases in the family, about their habits, their personal habits, about the kind of environment they live in, which means that they basically have to reflect upon themselves, and at least ideally, if we're not talking about areas covered by the directive, if the patient is talking to a doctor, for example, it's basically the patients that are putting together their own risk profiles, because without them it couldn't happen. And their individual environmental data are being combined with their particular genetic data to make it possible to put together their own genetic risk profile. Now, there are all kinds of ways of linking that data, the DNA sequence and the diversity of our environmental conditions enable a plethora of permutations, which means that very many profiles are possible. And it's in the interview that the DNA text becomes a basis for decision-making and action for the client. That's the only way it can acquire meaning. These environmental factors don't necessarily have to be diseases as such. The environmental data that is combined with the DNA text as a result of the linkage between the environment and gene, a certain norm or standard is created, which relates to particular pathologies. And this is where the eugenics comes into it, the self-eugenization. It's through the linking of data that the eugenics enter into it, the valuation. So the meaning that the data acquires through consultancy as a basis for action and decision making really cannot be isolated from that eugenic prospect. So as a result of the consultancy of the diagnosis, certain consequences will be drawn. But that assumes, again, that the clients of human genetics don't realize that they are basically producing the economically valuable data themselves. The clients themselves are encouraged to believe that they are recognizing some sort of nature which is within themselves. And on the basis of ideal standards, the genome can be used to read the textbook of their lives. So the interview itself assumes a kind of self-normalization, a self-pathologization and a self-eugenization. And the result of that is eugenic selection, which the patient, him or herself, is responsible for, based on a kind of standardized or idealized approach to the genome, which actually doesn't exist, which brings me on to the next hypothesis. Now, the interview with the consultant, and I'm sure you probably guessed this, is the springboard, I believe, for the translation of this meaningless DNA text into genetic information, which for the biotechnological industry becomes a commodity. But the effect of this translation is self-eugenization of the clients. They function as a kind, as an apparent self-management of human resources. But these human resources are a bit like the resources from which biotechnological industry can accumulate capital. So knowledge is being generated, but as this self-eugenization appears to be a self-recognition or recognition of one's own personal nature, this is the condition for consumption in the market. Okay, let me come to my conclusion. I would assert that the very idea that the human genome exists naturally, that is the human genome which is being decoded by the project, that this exists naturally outside the laboratory, is the very basis which enables the biotechnology industry to accumulate capital. The material basis for all this is eugenic selection, for which the consumers themselves are taking personal responsibility. And I would conclude and pass on to Sylvia Matis at this point, I'd like to talk about prenatal diagnosis, which we have in Germany at the moment. At the moment, in Parliament, the discussion sounds as though the PGD is a kind of humane alternative to prenatal diagnosis. Even our Chancellor, Schröder, argues this way. He says PGD can be a responsible alternative under certain medical conditions, but he doesn't even know what indications we're talking about at the moment. We've had prenatal diagnosis in Germany since the early 80s, and the important thing about prenatal diagnosis is that it's not about prevention. When it was sold to the public, it was based on hereditary selection. The unborn child, in 99% of cases, if a defect is discovered, is subject to therapy. And in many cases, this means the death of the child if certain things are suspected. Prenatal diagnosis has spread considerably. Gynecologists and hospitals have carried out such diagnosis. We already have hundreds of prenatal practices in Germany which have specialized on precisely that, quality control for unborn babies. So far, there are no state limits on that, no state controls, and certainly no due codes of conduct. The situation has been exacerbated considerably since then. Medical indications have now developed. A woman can abort up to the moment of birth if she feels that a child with disabilities threatens her existence. If a doctor explains the diagnosis in sufficiently negative terms, the woman is always going to be inclined to say, no, I don't want to live with a child like that. And that is one of the crucial questions. They talk now about directional consultancy, but I think this is a figment of the imagination. Maybe this takes place in some practices, but usually the doctor will see something on the ultrasound or has been testing the placenta waters, and even though without knowing what kind of disease this might indicate, questions are asked and the doctor will tend to say, look, you're probably going to have a baby like this, do you want one? And normally the women are so frightened that they say, of course I don't want a child like this, what are the chances? And then the doctors will tend to say, the child won't be able to talk or sense anything, you won't be able to continue in your job. And something I've often seen in practice is that often another ultrasound is done in order to verify this, and then very often new diagnoses are generated. I just met a woman, for example, where her child was diagnosed as Down syndrome. She thought about it for a bit and she said, I think I can live with this. We've had one in the family already. I think I can accept a child like that. And I already have two healthy children. And then the doctor looked again at the ultrasound and said, but it's probably got club feet as well. And I can see there's something wrong with the heart, which isn't in order. You can't expect the poor child to live with all these things. And then the woman said, I think I can expect the child to, and left the practice and was absolutely outraged, called a colleague. And a number of people said to her, how could you possibly want to give birth to a child like that? And I've made a lot of programs about things like this, and I get a lot of letters. I've seen it myself. It's happening all the time. And the second case, the second crucial issue is quality assurance. It sounds a bit malicious in this context, but in medicine, that's what they call it. In Germany, at the moment, the situation is that there is absolutely no monitoring of what diagnosis is offered by what doctor. A doctor will come up with something in the waters and the placental waters and will tell the woman the result. And then the question immediately is, do you want this baby or don't you? And of course, women in that situation are usually at the end of their tether, and they might say, I'll go to another doctor and have it verified, because normally pregnancy is so far advanced that the viability period has been attained, and the woman knows that if she takes the time to go to another doctor, she probably won't have a chance to abort any longer, or she will abort, but the child survives the abortion. And there are no regulations from the Chamber of Doctors straight after the diagnosis, therefore the abortion is carried out. Internally, it seems that this accounts for about 60% of these diagnoses were actually wrong, usually as a result of the ultrasound, but also in amniocentesis, there's a high rate of erroneous diagnosis because the punctuation was done wrong or the laboratory muddled up the test or whatever. And after that diagnosis, which nobody verifies, an abortion can immediately take place. Right up to the moment of birth. You have to bear that in mind.
So children are often born, and it has happened a couple of times. The German Medical Board stated the opinion that we have to get the term back to 22 weeks. But the other option is that the abortion process is started, and normally the process is such that the prostaglandin is at a level that is so high that the child will not survive the birth. Now, if there's a diagnosis, and obstetricians have told me this for years, the woman isn't told this because she usually doesn't want to see her child. They just let the child disappear and releases it for use by researchers. It's a very dark chapter. There are no statistics at all. Nobody knows what child has to die because of what diagnosis, and nobody knows exactly how many erroneous diagnoses happen in the clinics because the doctors and the obstetricians or midwives are obliged to keep silence. Now, the argument that a PGD is a more humane alternative, I think this is completely mistaken, because PGD does not exclude prenatal diagnostics. There's a study of the European IV centers which have examined just that. After PGD, there are even more pregnancy examinations than otherwise, because they always think that something could have happened to the cell. And then there's this hyperstimulation of the woman. She has to be hyperstimulated in order to
be able to undergo this method, there are often multiple pregnancies. And a woman doesn't only wants one child and not two, three, or four at the same time. That means children are killed in the womb, and only one child is allowed to be born. And the one which is allowed to be carried out is the one that looks the healthiest. So PGD, according to the studies of those doctors, causes even more abortions than normal pregnancy. So it's not an alternative, it's just a new method of selection, which will even increase this entire vicious cycle. Thank you very much. I have one question to Uta Wagenmann and to you, Ms. Matthies. Ms. Wagenmann said that research in this field, which you have compared and illustrated with a comparison to going public, so there's this trend to the virtual. The result of this research is usually tests and diagnosis methods rather than possible therapies. You bring it even more to the point, saying that now we have these testing methods, these diagnosing methods, which of course want to be applied, not least due to financial reasons or because of the reputation of the researchers. But there are a lot of erroneous diagnoses. You both said this. What's your assessment? Because the way the debate is going right now, all these questions that circle around PGD or prenatal diagnostics is discussed in such a way that it is a cycle for women who now have the possibility at a very early point in time to make sure that they give birth to a healthy baby, which is always the promise that is made to them. So the discussion is happening around a health debate, but a health-related debate must be about therapies. Now, you both said it's not really about therapies, but rather it's about testing methods, diagnostics, and also erroneous diagnosis. Well, yes, eventually, perhaps, they will talk about therapy. When genetic therapy is tested, they're probably also trying to test therapies for unborn children. So I think it's going to be about therapies eventually. Well, therapies, I think we have to go back to the concept of the gene. In my presentation, I tried to outline the trends, the structural and political basic trends, which are the basis for this promise of genetic engineering, genetic medicine, or genetified medicine. But of course, a gene therapy is a construction, it's a concept that has been around for quite a while. Genome research happened with the motivation of finding a genetic therapy. So this promise actually has led to the fact that we'll have to decode the genome, so we start right at the beginning. And then we'll start looking into gene sequences, coded areas that cause certain activities in the bodies. What are the effects? And then perhaps we can try to introduce new base couples and then find a therapy. But however, now when we talk about genome research, they're not immediately talking about therapy. This promise is always around, but the process of this first decoding the human genome was that the genes are now deeply rooted in our minds. And that's the point. 60% erroneous diagnosis. There are always these percentages around because there are all these dark sides of the application and diagnosis, and it's very difficult to come up with sound statistics. Now, even with the so-called, and I've been dealing with diagnostics. I have a lot to do with self-help groups, and they're often the these self-help groups, they're often the testing pool, particularly for genetic syndromes, which usually, in most cases, have occurrences of perhaps an incidence rate of 50, between 50 and 2,000 cases in the entire Federal Republic. So these are pathologies which genetic research has constructed that affect hardly any people. And because there's such a low incidence, but they know the definition of their disease or that of their children, they organize themselves as self-help group, saying that, of course, nobody's interested in us because there are just so few of us, and they're always very happy if somebody finds an interest in them. Now, often there are even researchers who call into existence such a self-help group in order to find people that they can later test. The best example is chorea Huntington. It's a very old and well-known disease. It hasn't just come up in the context of genome research. It's one of the very few diseases that are hereditary and whatnot. But this is always the classical example for a very clear genetically caused disease. The gene is there, and you either inherit it or not. So either you have the gene and then you have the disease, or you do not have the gene and you don't have the disease. But there are 3 or 4% of those cases where there are mutations. So even in a classical hereditary disease, the environment has some kind of influence on the pathology, but this is always ignored. So we stay within this model: genetic disease, genetic disposition, and then eventually perhaps the occurrence of the disease. And there's also cancer, diabetes. Alzheimer is the most recent example, the disease that is just being genetified, being defined as a genetic disease. Breast cancer too, but with breast cancer, that's a very interesting topic. Let me add this very quickly, because that's very interesting. There were 2 genes in 95 that were discovered, and then it was clear breast cancer is hereditary, but that's only the case in about 5% of all breast cancer cases, but the euphoria was already over. So this was largely ignored. But there are even researchers in human genetic that deal with the hereditary breast cancer, and even there, less than half of the people where there is a high occurrence of breast cancer in the family carry those genes. And on the other hand, the occurrence of breast cancer, if you have one of those genes, it's not clear if you will have breast cancer, when you will have breast cancer, and how. And there's a higher probability, but this leads to the fact that women have breast amputations just by way of prophylaxis. So the development, this is the development, these are the trends that have come up. The diseases that are attributed to a certain kind of mutation. And the next step would be behavior, character, or whatever. Well, what you're describing is that in the field of genetic engineering, it's more about research and application subsequently to research, but not the way it is really communicated for the benefit of the patient. The other point is, and this, I just want to provoke Mr. Lösch, could that be a reason why this self-eugenization is promoted to that extent? So on the one hand, there's nothing to be expected from genetic therapy, but at the same time, it creates a sort of imbalance. Perhaps you could say a few words about this. So although there is no therapy on the horizon, people use eugenic consultancy, and let me say this provocatively, they adhere to the gene as a sort of religion. So they stop going to a church, but they start believing in the gene. Well, let's see if I can bring this together. The eugenization, or this eugenics, it's an effect. It's the effect of the consultancy. I wouldn't say that people increasingly take to this because there is no therapy, but this consultancy concept rather is in line with the life management or life planning concept. And that's something that's quite normal, this neoliberal life management concept, as I would call it. So this claim to know as much as you can about yourself, to be able to exclude risks, or at least to know and be able to regulate your risks. So it's a lifestyle or life planning style, and this concept is in line with this. It's something that's happening in all kinds of fields. And this is why this kind of consultancy works, because it promises to deliver relatively clear and obvious data if they're processed in the right way. Now, of course, nobody is aware, or nobody thinks about the fact that these data, the genetic side of this risk concept, doesn't really tell you anything. The decoding of DNA is hard knowledge, is an important factor which precedes all the other factors, for example, in breast cancer, that are maybe much more dominating, or much more important. These other factors, they're not tangible. They don't seem as evident. And perhaps this is why people believe that here they have understood something very important, something, knowledge this is available to you that you can master, but you can never master your knowledge of all the other environmental factors. Product liability, what about product liability? What do you mean by product liability? Well, of course, the client of the consultancy is liable in the end. Because if the product is this link of risks, or this risk profile that is established by the DNA test and the environmental factor, and if the DNA test is just an image of part of my personality, then of course the client of the consultancy is a responsible subject, and therefore is liable for the product. So you take over the responsibility for your own life, the planning of your own life, and these genetic factors are part of this, but you have to say that this product for which you're liable, I mean, if the knowledge of the risk is the product, of course, the biotechnological industry should be liable for this product as well. But there is really no such thing as product liability in this field. The European directive on product liability, of course, you would think about green genetic engineering, but it could also be transferred to this. Of course, we always postpone what's more important. But I would say that this could also be transferred to knowledge about your genetic diagnosis. I think the problem is that these diagnoses, for example, if you have a fragile X, this is a gene that don't explain anything. It could mean that a child or an adult has a mental disability, but it could also come through, could master school or university without any problems. You don't know this from just seeing this gene. And you tell this to a woman in the 20th week of pregnancy, your child has a fragile X, do you want this child? So they explain it to her, she doesn't really know what this is. It could mean that the child has a mental disability, and it could mean that they use this genetic chip, which is already being used in research, but I think not really in the field. It's used in being used in research, but it's not safe enough to be used publicly. But with this chip, you will be able to see 2,000, to detect 2,000 diseases. Right now we're talking about 400. So these prenatal, these PGD clinics will be able to say, here we have a testing battery for 10 diseases which we could prevent. Do you want this? And of course they will compete. We can test dyslexia. Others will say we can test all other kinds of diseases, where tests may be developed very soon in the future. So if parents decide in favor of artificial insemination, they will go to the clinic which offers the most diseases to be which they can detect and then eventually cure. So if there is this genetic chip, it will also be used. I think it's also to be expected that the parents will go wherever they can obtain the genetic chip which can generate the clearest diagnosis. I mean, starting from my hypothesis, if I'm responsible for my own offspring and I am supposed to obtain the most comprehensive knowledge, of course I go to the clinic which offers the most tests. I mean, it would be logical. And if this is still being discussed in the insurance systems, if genetic tests are used as criteria, it will be asked for. There's a question from the audience. Genetic research, you talk about the liberalization. In Germany, we have the trend to regulate everything with legislation. But in the Third Reich, laws were not able to prevent what happened in psychiatry or wherever. The question is, what would you say about that? Between legislation and liberalization. Do you mean me? Well, if I talk about quality assurance in inverted commas, I don't know whether a profession should just be allowed to execute these delicate tests without any security measures or controls. We have this, also in inverted commas, most liberal regulation with late-term abortions. No EU countries has such hidden regulations as we do. It's hidden, but it's rather brutal. You can have an abortion right up to the date of birth, but it's pretended that this doesn't exist. I believe that the state should really intervene, that there's, for example, the obligation to obtain advice from people other than experts in human genetics. For example, obtain some advice by people who might actually advise you to have the child. And there should also be obligations to report and statistics. The statistics was being discussed, but one judge at the Constitutional Court told me that during the adoption of Section 218, the abortion law, this statistics was dropped the night before. So everybody wanted the statistics. Everybody wanted to know how many late-term abortions we have after the 22nd week, when the children are, when the fetuses are viable. However, we were just told the statistics. We won't have the statistics, and we don't have the statistics. So the numbers vary between 200 and 800 late-term abortions. And if I listen to the midwives, the obstetricians, how many abortions, late-term abortions they have per quarter, these are frightening figures. So I think that the government is really afraid of making this an issue because they're saying we don't have to regulate this, we leave it up to the medical community, but they don't want to. They want legislation. Coming back to legislation, I could only say that I think there are more and more signs pointing into that direction that there be a comprehensive